Hello and welcome to Keeping Tracks on URN. Today we will be keeping tracks with Dr. Paul Smith, who will jump into a zombie apocalypse where he will be stranded in Trent Building with limited resources. During the 2017 French presidential campaign, his various media appearances reached 58 million people and made somebody £3.5 million. Unfortunately, he made nothing. Yet, despite this, he still has a smile on his face. Dr. Paul Smith, welcome.
Hello, how are you doing? I'm very well, thank you. Very well, thank you.
Perfect. So, as an associate professor in French and Francophone studies and head of department, within the French department at Nottingham, it's fair to say you are a bit of a local hero. May I ask, who was your hero growing up?
That's a very good question. I had loads of heroes, but my swimming coach, principally a guy called Charlie Wilson. I grew up in the town of Bedford. And swimming was my thing. I mean, I very much enjoyed school and all the stuff that went on there. But first thing in the morning and early evenings were given over to swimming in the chlorinated pit that was, quite by chance, my old school swimming pool. And Charlie was kind of a role model. Not really, he was a role model in the sense that he was somebody who didn't suffer fools gladly. And unfortunately, I kind of have that trait. But that would be my hero.
And is swimming something that... Is swimming a passion of yours that you continue today?
Yeah, I'm in the university pool most mornings before I go and teach you guys. I go and plough up and down the pool from 6:30 to 7:30. So if you don't want to bump into me in the pool, don't go there from 6:30 till 7:30 most weekday mornings.
Paul, I've had a sneak peek of the songs that you've chosen today, and more than one predominantly features the electric guitar.
Yeah.
What is your relationship with the guitar?
Well, I don't play it. I'm pretty fabulous though with a tennis racket. I can certainly do some outstanding air guitar solos. And a lot of my heroes were actually not so much guitarists, but bass guitarists. If you look at the list, there's a couple of tracks there, one by Rush, the other by Motorhead. And of course, the key driving forces there are, not that Fast Eddie was a bad guitarist, and Alex Lifeson of Rush is a fabulous guitarist, both of them seriously underrated, but the real driving force behind the music there are the bass guitarists. So that's Lemmy for Motorhead and Geddy Lee of Rush. So I can't play the guitar. I just don't have the coordination. But I always, as a kid, you know, would grab my mum's old tennis racket and from a very early age and play along.
You may not have the best guitaring skills in the world, but you have set me up very nicely indeed for our first song. Tell me a bit about your first choice.
The Pretenders, Message of Love, was... I had the first Pretenders album. A girlfriend of mine bought it for Christmas. I hadn't really switched on to the Pretenders, and then I listened to this stuff and... You know, talking of bass guitarists, the late Pete Farndon was an absolutely outstanding bass guitarist, and James Honeyman as well, the guitarist as well. They were just a great combination. But actually, this song, Message of Love, isn't on that first album. It doesn't appear on any albums apart from the greatest hits. It was kind of dropped out of thin air, and I bought this back in the day when I didn't really have a record player, but I had a cassette player, and you could buy cassette singles, and I still have it. It's the one and only cassette single that I've kept down the years. And what I really love about this song is there's that kind of bridge bit after the chorus, particularly as the song fades out, which I just love the way it drives along. And the guitar sound and the bass combination here is just absolutely fabulous. And it's 1981 and I'm 18 years old and I'm preparing my A-levels.
Without further ado, this is Message of Love by The Pretenders. Sweet.
Okay.
Anything you want to add or change or do again?
Content-wise, production-wise,
cool, okay. And in terms, I haven't actually been looking at these two. Are they all similar?
Yeah, you can sort of also tell from what we can see on the screen.
Sweet.
That was going to happen down there, so...
Yeah, all good? Sweet, okay. So next we're going to talk about... So you mentioned your cassettes. I'm going to ask you a bit about how you got into music and
okay.
And how it's changed and that kind of thing.
Okay.
That was Message of Love by The Pretenders. Paul, you mentioned briefly before the song that you listened to cassettes growing up. I was just wondering, how has your relationship with music changed over the years, and in particular, how you've listened to music?
Okay, well, if we go back to the origin sort of thing, I was actually a chorister. I was a boy soprano as a young kid, and I liked to sing, and my dad was a great singer. And, you know, back in the day when we didn't have radios or cassette players in cars, back in the 1970s, we used to have to entertain ourselves, so we sang. And that was really how I started on my journey with music. And then, as you say, we listened to cassettes. Of course, the thing that we all did was we used to buy records, and then, or somebody would buy a record, and we'd all give them cassettes to tape the records onto. And of course, that killed music, as we all know. That was, you know, they used to have these things when you pulled the record out of the sleeve, it would say home taping is killing music, and clearly that was true. So that's irony, by the way, irony. And so that's how we kind of listened to music. So, you know, you'd have a vinyl that you really, really loved and you wore out. You know, I've got records that I can't listen to anymore because they're simply completely worn out, like Cheap Trick Live at the Budokan, for example. But you'd tape that onto a cassette for your mates and you'd distribute that. And that was how we listened to it. So you might go around to a mate's house and listen to a record in their bedroom, or if their parents were out on their dad's really expensive hi-fi that he didn't know how to use properly, or you would distribute the stuff that way. You know, we had our ways of exchanging music. And of course, those of us who could bear to stay up past 10 o'clock at night would listen to John Peel, because that was the music connoisseurs radio program. And then for the rockers, and you know, basically I was a guitar band fan, it was Friday evenings listening to Tommy Vance on Radio 1. That was what we listened to. How's it changed? Well, I mean, it's changed in the same way as everybody's listening habits have changed. You know, then we moved into CDs, which kind of, I find CDs were a bit odd, because I've got this thing about CDs. I think you can put too much music on a CD. You know, the classic LP was 40 minutes, and that was probably pretty much your maximum. And you had two sides to an LP, and that was it. And then CDs came along, and suddenly you had to put 80 minutes on it. And the concept of listening to the first side and then flipping the thing over, and the, you know, starting the second side out with a really great song, that's kind of gone. And that's what I really miss about the way we listen to music nowadays. And people put too much music on LPs. You know, if you can't say it in 40 minutes, don't bother.
I think it's fair to say that the drama of at least unboxing a music track has somewhat disappeared. I was just wondering if you think there's any magic in streaming and downloading music.
Are you kidding? Absolutely not. No. I mean, you know, I remember how excited I was about buying my copy of Live and Dangerous by Thin Lizzy. I mean, that was such a great album. You know, the 1970s was great to grow up for music, because it was the decade of the live album. And you'd wait for a band would do three or four studio albums and then do a live album. And then I remember buying that album in town and then having to go home on the bus. And you've got that incredible buzz. And then you put the thing on the record player, and then, you know, it was just, whereas streaming stuff, it's way too easy. It's, you know, and everybody's got so much disposable nowadays that they can just endlessly do that. Whereas we used to have to save up. You couldn't buy an album every week. You bought an album every month if you were lucky. You know, and a double album was going to cost you $5.99. Well, I know that doesn't sound like very much nowadays, but when you're making £1 a week pocket money, that's a large bit of wedge.
So the accessibility of music is now at a stage where anybody can make a mixtape, anybody can appear on Spotify and Apple Music. I was just wondering if you thought that there were advantages in terms of being able to access such a wide variety of music so easily.
Yes, of course there are. I mean, one of the things that I really, you know, you'd read, we lived for, I mentioned John Peel, we lived for listening to Tommy Vance. And of course, the other thing we used to absolutely devour, if we liked music, were the weekly music newspapers. And they'd tell you about the stuff. So these were newspapers like the New Musical Express, the Melody Maker, and there was a relatively short-lived newspaper called Sounds, which was much more your kind of your metal and prog rock, all right, all that kind of stuff. You could read about this stuff, and they would do their best to tell you what the music was like, but you couldn't actually. Even John Peel wasn't playing this stuff. Even Tommy Vance wasn't playing it. So it was very difficult to get hold of and to listen to, because some of it was pretty obscure. So the advantage you have now with YouTube, with Spotify, with everything that's online, is you can actually go online, listen to it, and say, "Yeah, I like that, and I want to listen to a bit more of that." So I absolutely, you know, it would be crazy to say things aren't better now, but there was this. There was this kind of anticipation that I don't think you have quite so much nowadays.
Your second track, you've chosen Overkill by Motorhead.
Yeah.
Given you are stuck in Trent Building, surrounded by zombies, in a potentially life-threatening situation, what do you hope that this song will bring to you?
Well, I find it a really energising track, actually. I mean, when you ask me to think about five pieces of music... You know, these things are always a little bit sort of, they're partly biographical and they're also partly about where you are when the question is asked. But I always find something by Motorhead gets me in the mood for something that's going to require a little bit of energy. One of my psych up songs for when I'm about to do an open water swim is Heavy Metal Thunder by Saxon, and I kind of ummed and ahed about putting this in as well, but in the end it had to be Lemmy, and it has to be Overkill. I mean, what a great track. You know, rock and roll ain't worth a damn if it don't make you strut. It's such a great song, and there's a live version of it where he played it with the last lineup, which is absolutely brilliant. I mean, there's a really unfortunate version as well of this. I don't know if you know it, but at Glastonbury, where he confuses the lyrics to Ace of Spades with the tune of Overkill, because they're pretty similar. And that was also the problem with the Motorhead album, is that you kind of recognise this track from the last album. But yeah, it's I find it's Overkill is a fabulously energetic song. And of course, the classic with Filthy Taylor on drums is just mind-blowing.
So without further ado... Here is Overkill by Motorhead. Yep, yeah, think that went well.
You're sounding much more...
I am. So, yeah. Yeah, I thought like last time was a bit robotic.
Well, we can go back and redo the first section if you want. It's up to you.
No. I thought that was great content, to be honest. Okay. I think you're a natural when it comes to this. Or maybe you're not a natural, just... after so many appearances on French radio and televised broadcasts.
It's always that weird thing when people come into the radio station. Got a really good voice for radio. It's so nice to listen to. But I feel like I can't say that because that sounds weird.
No, I feel like it is the case here, definitely. I feel like my voice isn't quite up to scratch, but we'll do something about that.
Well, it helps to have a little bit of bronchitis, I find. You know, you can kind of... Yeah. You can practice your Tom Hardy.
This is exactly what I'm thinking. Maybe I need to get him in the studio and give me some tips.
Just so long as he selects the right accent.
Yeah, that's true. Have you seen Legend?
No.
It's about the Kray twins.
The Kray twins. No,
Fantastic film.
I watched Taboo, which was on while you were on your year abroad. It was a kind of TV vehicle. It's basically Tom Hardy's TV vehicle, and they clearly gave him the right to do whatever he wanted. And it's a slightly odd series. But it's Tom Hardy in the dark a lot, being sort of half photographed. Mm-hmm. But his accent, there was an article in The Guardian talking about his accent. It said, where is that accent? Because there are bits where he comes over as really, really Welsh, you know, sort of South Wales. And then he go a bit sort of Cockney, you're out of order. And then it would be this kind of mid-Atlantic stuff as well, because he's actually an American spy. You only realise at the very end that this American sort of spy master that they're talking about is him. So, you know, spoiler alert, yeah, spoiler alert for a series that was on last year. Oh, I hadn't realised that. Mm. The punchline is, yeah.
Yeah, Legend. Fantastic film.
I've seen clips of it, but I've never. I'm not a big. See, my problem with it is that I'm not a great one of for making heroes out of people who are fundamentally murderers. You know, and the Krays are. That's what they were. You know, nasty, let's not muck about. Let's not. People. Yeah, they were nasty people, and that whole kind of honor amongst thieves and all that kind of thing. I don't go for that. So, but you know, I'll give it a swing.
Was his accent in Taboo akin to? Dick Van Dyke's.
It wasn't quite. No, it wasn't quite Dick Van Dyke. Maury Poppins. Things are magic with Maury Poppins. No, it wasn't quite that bad.
It's
but
a jolly holiday
with Maury. Yeah, no, it's a. It varies. It wobbled quite a lot. It wobbled quite a lot, and it had some. It was an odd series because it had some bits where it got really quite interesting and quite promising, and then they just dropped bits of the story because they clearly hadn't worked out how to work it out.
Yeah, I've seen one or two of those.
Yeah.
Cool, should we get back to
okay.
music? So I'm going to introduce... so this is the book section.
Okay.
And then back to music and then
okay.
back on track. Is there anything you want to talk about in particular? Any leading questions that you want me to ask? Or...
No, not particularly.
More generally, is there anything that you want me to kind of probe you about or anything, you know, any messages?
No, anything that you think's interesting from a student's point of view to ask of a university lecturer of 25 years experience. All right, dot off. 25 years. Done a lot of work for charity, but don't like to talk about that. No, don't ask that because I don't do any work for charity. Yeah, 25 years. They gave me a £100 book token, so that's nice. £4 a year. You see, the university values its employees.
Who needs pensions when you've got
who needs a pension fund when you've got £100? It's not a book token, I tell a lie, it's a John Lewis token.
A John Lewis token.
But I've discovered I can use it at Waitrose. So the beers are on me.
Game changer. I look forward to it.
It's shifting the whole thing.
Great, okay. Let's go on to the book section. And that was Overkill by Motorhead. Now we're going to talk about books, Paul. How much of a reader would you say that you are?
I read a lot. I mean, I'm not a devourer of books. My wife reads two or three books a week. I probably, you know, read a book a month kind of thing. But in my line of business, you know, you've got to read a fair amount of stuff to keep up to date. Although development of the internet and... material that's available through various electronic sources, that's taking up a lot more of my reading time than it used to. But I love books, and anybody who's had their class in my office knows that it's full of books. My students actually spend most of their tutorials with their head on one side looking at the titles of the books on the bookshelf. So that's good.
Students still interested in books?
Students are still interested in reading the titles of books, yeah, because I think that they think it gives them some kind of aperçu into the psychology of the person who's teaching them. I think that's, and what's very interesting as well, I don't know if you've noticed this with French books, but the French put the titles on the spine the other way around. So you know when, you can always spot when students are reading a series of English titles, because their head goes one side, and then, this is great radio, by the way, boys and girls, and then you tilt the head the other way, because then you realise that they're looking at the other titles, the French titles are the other way around. So, yeah, they're still interested in books, and they ask me if I've read them, and I have most of them, yeah. So, yeah, I like books.
And in terms of your first book that you choose in this zombie apocalypse, tell me a bit about that.
Wainwright's The Central Fells. Well, in the zombie apocalypse, assuming that, you know, I can't get out and I've got to kill some time, The Central Fells by Wainwright has been a book that's been by my side ever since I was a child. My mum was an avid fell wanderer, and our holidays were spent up in the Lake District, a place called Langdale, and mum would drive us up there during Easter or summer holidays, park the car, and we just didn't leave the campsite for 2 weeks, and you just walked and walked and walked. And from Langdale, the Wainwright, because, you know, everybody knows who Wainwright is nowadays, but back in the day he was really niche reading, but the Wainwright you need most for walking from Langdale is the Central Fells. That's the Langdale Fells. It gives you Bow Fell, all of those hills around there, and that was where what we learnt from. So the OS map plus the Central Fells, and of course, you know, Wainwright's illustrations and his descriptions of the walks are second to none, and they remain absolutely spot on. You know, even 40, 50, 60 years after they were first written, the hills remain essentially the same. I mean, the paths have been updated and are better maintained than they used to be, but that was the you know, the basic guides are still there. And so that's, I guess it's partly... It's slightly fetishistic in the sense that it's a book that you touch, you feel, it resonates. It's it's more than just a novel. I mean, you know, in novels, characters reach out to you and you identify maybe with them, or you're repulsed by others. But in a book like The Central Fells, which is a practical book, you're touching something that you remember from your childhood. You know, I started, as I say, the first time I went up Bow Fell was in my mother's womb. So, you know, it is going back an awfully long way.
As someone who clearly has a passion for swimming, and also apparently since even before birth, a passion for walking in the hills, do you think that being trapped inside Trent Building would drive you insane, or do you manage loneliness well?
No, I manage loneliness pretty well. I mean, I remember when I first started as a postgraduate student at the University of Oxford, we had a briefing with the then Regius Professor of History at Oxford, a guy called Michael Howard, and he said, you know, as a doctoral student, you will find that it's one of the loneliest things that you can do is write a doctorate, and you have to be really self-reliant and resourceful as a doctoral student. I mean, I know that sounds a bit precious, and probably it is, but you do nevertheless have to be able to put up with your own company. So I don't think it would be... I handle solitude pretty well. I mean, you talk about swimming and hill walking, but yes, you're outside doing those things, particularly for an open water swimmer like me. But actually, you're with yourself. And if you're not good with yourself when you're swimming 15, 20, 25 kilometres in not terribly warm water, then you're in trouble. So you've got to be pretty self-reliant.
It's time to listen to some more music. Please could you tell us about your third selection?
Yeah, Handwritten by the Gaslight Anthem. I thought I probably ought to give you some reasonably up-to-date stuff. Brian Fallon played at Rock City last week here in Nottingham. He's the lead singer and the lyric writer, guitarist with the Gaslight Anthem. I hadn't really come across them until about 2010, and it was my younger nephew Ben who gave me an old iPlayer of his, a little iPod shuffle, to listen to. And I'd given his dad a record by a band called The Hold Steady, called Boys and Girls in America. And Ben had listened to that, and he said, well, Uncle Paul, if you like, or Unky Paul, as he calls me, you know, if you like Americana, you'll love this. And it was the Gaslight Anthem. The album was the 59 Sound. And I just love Brian Fallon. I mean, you know, that first album of the Gaslight Anthem, Sink or Swim, is a fabulous, fabulous album. There's not a bad track on there. But I really loved as well the follow-up, and it wasn't the follow-up to the 59 Sound, but the one after that, Handwritten, is the album. And this is the title track, and it's just absolutely encapsulate everything the Gaslight Anthem is about. Great lyrics, really great music, and a jolly good sing-along chorus.
I don't need to do anything else to add to that. Cool. Sweet.
Yeah.
Anything?
No.
No. No. I might re-record one question. Okay. Just for me. Which one was it? I wouldn't go that far. I said, are you a good reader? But I didn't phrase it very well. I said. You say, would you consider yourself to be
an avid reader?
That's just my question.
Okay, okay.
Is that a good question?
That's a good question.
Would you consider yourself to be an avid reader?
I consider myself to be.
You don't need. So we've already recorded that.
Okay.
The track. So.
Okay.
Yeah, that was good. I thought.
Okay.
Perfect. Looking at these football, I think this was the five beside. Are you a football fan?
Not really. Well, I am, but
I love how they've had to say how it's pronounced as well. How would you say that is if you have all the dashes and the phonetic?
It's sort of phonetic, isn't it?
Kind of.
Well presented.
That's not at all patronising, is it? That's not at all patronising. That doesn't remind me at all of a Harry Enfield skips. Where's the bloke? Where's the bloke, love? Where's the bloke? Go and fetch us a cup of tea. Where's the bloke? Bring us the bloke.
Have you seen Only Fools and Horses recently?
No.
Watching it back is... Well, I wasn't there for when it came out originally, but watching it back now is a very different experience, I imagine, to what it would have been like originally.
Well, a lot of the comedy... There was actually Harry Enfield and Paul Whitehouse, you know, one of their last series, did a spoof on a comedy series from the early 70s called On the Buses, and it was awful. But their spoof was actually not very far from the truth. But when you remember it, I mean, it's a bit like there was another series which was called Love Thy Neighbour, and it was all about a white family who have a West Indian family moving next door. And all the references, you know, the terms that are used, it would absolutely frighten the living daylights out of you. But the commonplace expressions that people used about West Indians back in the day. Or? Oh no, this is the 1970s. Back in the 1970s, and it wasn't Sid James. That was another series where he had the two. He was the father. That's not Father Dear Father, Bless This House. And he's got two late teenage daughters, so he's coping with all of that sort of business. But there was this other series called Love Thy Neighbour, and it's about, about a black West Indian couple family moving in next door to you and how you cope with that. And it was, it was pretty, it would make your toes curl if you saw it nowadays.
Yeah, it is weird watching all that kind of stuff.
But the fundamental sexism of comedy in the 70s and even into the 1980s, I mean, it's only when the young ones came along and started saying, look, you know, you can't do tits and bum gags, you know, that's not what it's all about. You know, there's something else has to be done.
Even watching things like Little Britain, which only came out kind of 10, 15 years ago, some of the referencing all the minstrels and all that kind of thing.
The minstrels thing was in its own right a reference to something that we grew up with, my generation, which was dying out then. But it was a show called The Black and White Minstrel Show, and it was white women and black minstrels, but the minstrels were all white guys blacked up. Okay. And they would do the songs from the South. So, you know, they would sing things like Old Man River and all that, but they would be blacked up, and they would all be, you know, it was kind of the idea of, it wasn't really set on an old paddle steamer, but you got that sense that this was a variety show, and it kind of died out in the middle of the 1970s, but that parody, that what Little Britain are doing is parodying the blacked up men. There's a sketch in Goodness Gracious Me. They did a send up of that as well, and they use the song The Men in Black. They turn it around and call it The Blacked Up Men, and so they do this thing about how at a certain point you had to have, and in some ways they're even sending up something like Gandhi, you know, who plays Gandhi is Ben Kingsley. I was trying to remember the name. Dickie Attenborough, you know, does he cast an Indian as Gandhi? No, he cast Ben Kingsley in makeup, you know. So a film which actually in so many ways opened out, you know, I'd never heard of the massacre at Amritsar because you didn't hear about that aspect of British colonial rule, you know. It was all, even though there was this kind of left-wing social conscience in the 1970s, that kind of stuff was still very much pushed to one side. But when they made the movie, they cast a white man as the central figure. You know, that's crazy.
Yeah, we're supposed to be making progress. I don't know. I don't know quite how that fits in.
No.
Do you reckon we could use that for for other content? you know, the other show that we're about? What is it? Me and culture show. Do you reckon we could use it for that?
Potentially.
We'll listen to it back and see.
If not,
see how it is.
Keep it in this because that was really good discussion.
Yeah, honestly, you're making my job so easy.
Okay.
So easy. Just keep on going. This is going fantastically. I think. Yeah.
Give me reassurance.
Okay. Perfect. So we're going to talk about that fourth song.
Yep.
I might ask you about your relationship with France and how you got into how you got into French. And that was handwritten by the Gaslight Anthem. I mentioned previously that you're an associate professor in French and Francophone studies, as well as being head of department.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about your journey to your position currently.
Well, it all started with family holidays. It used to make me laugh that back in the day when I was reading UCAS forms and applications for students who wanted to come to the University of Nottingham, they'd say, ever since I went on holiday to France with my parents, and we'd all sort of sit around and laugh. And then I thought about it, and I thought, well, Paul, how did you get here? And the answer to that question is that my parents took me on holiday to France, and I spent a lot of very happy holidays in France, and I got on with the language. I'm not a natural linguist. I don't speak terribly good German. My Russian is pretty basic. I don't have any command of Mandarin, but I get on okay with French, and I got on okay with French at school. And so I actually didn't do French as a first degree. Here we come. Here's the big revelation moment. Dr. Smith doesn't have a degree in French. I did history. I did East European history at the University of London as my first degree. Then I went up to Oxford. And there I did a master's, and that was where I met the guy who would become my thesis supervisor, a guy called Robert Gilday, who's now the professor of modern European history at the University of Oxford. And he said, well, what do you want to do a thesis on? And I said, well, I'm not much good at British history. I don't really enjoy British history. I don't have the languages to do East European history. So he said, we'll have to be French, because I had A-level. And that was that, really. And I picked my topic. I worked on the women's movement in France in the 30s and 40s, the 20s and 30s, looking at why women didn't get the vote in France until after the Second World War. That's really what my thesis was about, feminist organisations. And then I came into the job market when language departments were beginning to change. I mean, one of the things you guys won't be aware of, because to you it seems very normal, but the old pattern for a language department was basically language and literature. There weren't very many people teaching cinema. Nobody was doing contemporary Chinese politics, you know. And you might say, well, nobody's doing it now either, Dr. Smith. But anyway, you know, none of that stuff was available. And then that all began to change. And I got the job. I had a couple of jobs before I came to Nottingham, one in a modern language department at Salford. Then I was at Dublin for a year in history, teaching the Irish their own history. And then I came to Nottingham in 1992, and the rest is ancient history. So that's how I got into France, and I've stuck there ever since, and that's become my niche.
As a French student myself, a lot of people ask me how I find French society and whether it is indeed that different from English society. I was just wondering, from your experiences of going to France on holidays and going to France in other periods, what would you say is the biggest cultural difference?
The French are actually, despite what one thinks about them, they're very, they're a very polite people. And of course, they're very regulated. You know, the way they live their lives, their days are very clearly marked out. So, you know, getting up in the morning, you have breakfast, then you have, you know, lunches at midday, and then you've got the goûter at 4, and, you know, time is very much regulated. But I was having this discussion with a final year student who was telling me about, you know, how the French don't work, and, you know, apart from the fact that the French are actually more productive than the British. But the point is that the French look like they don't work very hard because they're actually doing it at different times of the day. So, and French people who come here, for example, find it absolutely crazy that Beeston is shut from 5 o'clock in the evening. You know, French people, how on earth are you going to do the shopping after work if you don't finish till 6? Because the French don't finish work till 6 or 7 in the evening. How are you going to do your shopping if all the shops are shut from 5 o'clock in the evening? So I think that's the really big difference, that the French live their lives, that, you know, that the timing of their day is very different, that that's the biggest shock. And I think that people aren't really ready for that when they go to France, because, you know, if you're going to go, you know, from your own experience, Finn, if you go to China, you expect there to be a massive culture shock, and indeed there is. When you only go across the English Channel, you think that the French are just going to be people, English people who speak French, but they're not. The way that they perceive their time, the way they use time, the way they perceive their lives, the rhythms of the year, you know, they're very different to the British, and that's something that one really has to work quite hard to get over. And I love it. You know, I think that their capacity for turning up to do jobs around my house after 6 o'clock in the evening, that's not something that you would get a British plumber to do, but the French plumber, you know, he'll come and do the job in the time that he's got and when it needs to be done. So, but I think that's quite a big difference. And because it's at such a sort of minor level, it can be quite shocking that to get used to that.
It's time to talk about your final book. What have you gone for?
I've gone for a book that's been with me for a very long time. I did this as an A-level student, and it's Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier. And I just think it is an absolutely beautiful book. It's a book about passion. The opening line is, "This is the saddest story that I've ever heard." And it is one of the saddest stories that I've ever heard. It's a story about a soldier, oddly enough. I'm not going to give too much away. No spoilers. But it's written from the point of view of one of the protagonists, but not the good soldier. It's about this group of people who, there are all kinds of stories about their loves between them that the others don't seem to know about, which very slowly are kind of unpicked. And the central character, the good soldier, Edward Ashburnham, is a really very complicated character. And you know, at the end, it's all quite tragic, but it's tragic in a quite uplifting sort of way. You don't feel like you don't feel empty after you've read it, and it's a book I go back to once every maybe 3 or 4 years. You know, it's just a very pleasant read, and it is so well written. I think Ford Madox Ford is a seriously underestimated writer. You might have heard of Parade's End by him, but there's, you know, he's absolutely brilliant, and I love this book. And as I say, I did it for A-level, which, you know, for most people that kind of kills literature, but it didn't for me. It really opened my eyes, and I love it.
One thing that stood out to me when I was doing a bit of research on the book was just simply the name of the author. Is he so good that they named him twice?
He's actually related to the artist Ford Madox Brown, the Pre-Raphaelite artist. Yeah, he is good. He is good. Ford Madox Ford. But it's, yeah, I don't know why he's Ford Madox Ford and not Ford Madox something else. But yeah, he's good. He's pretty good.
It's time now for your final song. What are we going to be hearing?
My fourth song. Is it my final song or my fourth song?
You had Limelight yet?
No.
It is now time for your fourth song, Dr. Smith.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about it.
Okay, well, this is the band that's basically provided the soundtrack to my life. There you are. There's today's cliche, and there have been a few, but that's the cliche de cliche, the soundtrack of my life. I discovered Rush in about 1977-78. They're a band that aren't terribly fashionable, or haven't been until quite recently, and then they... About 4 or 5 years ago, all of those people like, you know, the Foo Fighters kind of began to confess to, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, how much they'd been influenced by Rush. And they were inducted into the Hall of Fame and all that kind of stuff, which was great. But they are a three-piece, Canadian three-piece. That was always a recommendation, that they weren't American. They're a Canadian three-piece, and the noise that they make, the first time I heard them, I thought, how on earth can three guys make all of that racket? And they're three fabulous musicians, Alex Lifeson on the guitars, Geddy Lee on the bass and the vocals, and Neil Peart, who's generally regarded as being one of the best rock drummers ever. Well, you know, we could have that argument all night long, but certainly a very accomplished drummer, but also the lyricist. How many bands are there, do you know of, that have the drummer as the lyricist? Would all write arguably Genesis, but we won't talk about Phil Collins. But you know, this three piece, and then they, and I was listening to them in the from the late 70s onwards, and then they came out with this album 1981, the album Moving Pictures, and there is seriously not a bad track on that entire album. From the moment they kick off with Tom Sawyer, which I kind of thought about saying, yep, I'll pick Tom Sawyer. And then there's YYZ. Well, anybody who's a musician has to know how to play YYZ. That's, you know, supposedly the one of the reference points. If you're any kind of rocker, you know how to play YYZ. And then there's Red Barchet. And so it goes through the whole album. And then I thought, well, no, the one that really back in the day used to glue my ears to the speakers and still does, because it just has that most fabulous introduction, is Limelight. And that's where Neil Peart is talking about how difficult it is to be a rock star. And, you know, it's a really thoughtful song, and it's the lyrics. Rush's lyrics were as important as the music. And it's actually the bass line is great, but for once we also get an absolutely blistering guitar solo from Alex Lifeson, one of his favourites. And I think that this song just brilliantly showcases everything that they're about, and it's bloody noisy as well, and that's something I really like.
Turn your stereos up. This is Limelight, Rush. I'll do that again. Turn your stereos up. This is Limelight, Rush.
Very nicely introduced.
Thank you. Okay, so there's nobody after us, is there?
No.
Okay, I think we might write slightly over. We just got last song, and then Luxury.
Yeah, I still haven't thought what my luxury item is. Oh my god, oh my god.
Hot tub? No,
hot tub. Underground swimming pool.
Underground swimming pool.
Luxury item in the Trent building.
I can also throw into the conversation while you're quick Wikipedia search. Ford, Malex Ford, changed his surname to Ford because it was originally Heffer.
Interesting.
Apparently.
That's not very creative, though, to go with a name that you already have.
Hmm, interesting. A luxury item in the Trent building. I'd just love to have some fountains around the back of the Trent building. That would be nice.
Maybe you could go swimming in the fountain.
No, I'd like them to be in some kind of neo-Nazi setting out the back of the Portland building. That would be my luxury night. No, I'm being doing a bit of irony there.
That was it.
Luxury item.
We could.
Are people cheeky about their luxury items? Do they sneak in extra records? Do they do that sort of thing?
Our last guest had Scrabble, and we allowed her a dictionary to accompany the Scrabble.
Okay. Yep. All right. Yeah, I would. Yes. All right. Then, in that case, yeah, I've got a luxury item.
You're going to tell me?
Yes, I will tell you what it is. It's okay. A computer with solitaire on it.
A computer with solitaire on it.
Because I got absolutely obsessed when solitaire first came out on my first little laptop, which was about that deep and that thing. I used to have this thing about winning, but going out for zero. Okay. So that you, as the player, you had to get zero. You won, but you had to get zero marks. And if you got 1 point, you had to start again.
Forget about it.
And the ideal game is to shoot the moon 4 games running. That is perfection. Shooting the moon, 4 hands running. So you dump you win all the points. Do you play solitaire, hearts.
Hearts. I was slightly confused about that.
So computer with hearts. Holidays, and they all hate me now.
I've never played that. You know, I did used to play quite a lot of solitaire, and it's quite satisfying because at the end you get.
But that solitaire is wrong, because the way I was taught to play solitaire anyway. So you had the 3-card draw. So you had your cards out, and you went alternating colours. But when you went 1, 2, 3. But you changed the order, so the cards weren't going to keep coming out in the same order. Otherwise. Once they'd gone through them once and you discovered that you couldn't get the right card, you were never going to get the right cards out. Mm-hmm. Whereas 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So it was always, you're always drawing it in a way that, I can't remember how to do it now, but I could do if I had a pack of cards. Anyway, no, hearts is my thing. That would be my luxury. To while away the hours.
We'd certainly take a lot of hours.
Okay.
Okay. Last track. Let's do this.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, just did something. Oops. And that was Limelight by Rush. Our next track is somewhat different from the previous ones, in that it not only does not feature a guitar, it doesn't actually feature anything to do with any of it. How would you describe it again? It was Greek.
Well, it's a piece of religious music. It's a Russian Orthodox chant from Vespers by Rachmaninoff, and it's Vesper number 2. It's sung mostly by an alto female voice, but it has fabulous bass tones right at the very end, and it's got this tremendous depth to it, and I find that it's a piece of music that puts everything right.
So if I were to stand outside the Smith household during shower time, would I hear it being belted out?
You might do, actually. It's not unknown for me to try and recreate those bass notes at the end, you know, when I'm in a particular... I mean, it's the thing about this piece is that it's religious. I'm not a person of faith, particularly, but, you know, it's a piece of music that I find puts everything right. Not just the tenor, but those bass notes right at the very end. I mean, it is a piece of music that you have to wait for at the end. You have to get the right recording, because some of the recordings, they tend to throw away those bass notes at the end. But as they step down, as the male bass voice goes all the way down to the bottom, if the conductor, the choir master and the choir have taken their time, then it just hangs there at the very end, and they're such low. I think it's a C that's right at the very end, and it just absolutely, you know, blows my socks off. And it is a piece of music that when everything's going wrong, all I have to do is put this on, and it just brings back my equilibrium. And that's why it's song number 5, because, you know, I'm going to need some equilibrium while we're fighting off this zombie apocalypse.
Maybe with any luck, these zombies will have a musical ear and might even join in.
Well, they might do. Or with the other bit of luck we might have is that bass note at the end is so deep that they actually explode. And that would be the cherry on top of the icing on the top of the cake.
Perfect. Without further ado, here is Bless the Lord, O My Soul, from Vespers by Rachmaninoff. Sweet, I'm going to re-record something. remember what I said? I said it's very different from... I might just re-record it, actually. It was... coming up, we have a song which shares very few similarities with the previous...
It has absolutely nothing in common with
it
the...
That's probably a good thing to say. Okay. Coming up, we have a song that has... Rewind... Coming up, we have a song that is... Coming up.
Okay. Now have a song.
Well, why don't you say something like, so your last choice is a piece of music that has absolutely nothing in common with the four other pieces. It's a piece of religious music. Could you explain a bit about that choice?
Do you want to come sit on this chair? You have to pay your £5 to come join the society, but I think you'll nail it. Right.
Well, I've got £95 left over from my my 25 years service.
Go to Waitrose, it'll be fine. So your last choice is something that has absolutely nothing in common with your previous choices. In fact, it is inherently religious. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's a piece of religious music.
We good? Will that be good? Will that link in fairly well?
Yeah, that's fine.
Sweet.
I will say this though, you're going to become aware when you edit this of how often you say that.
Yeah.
The reason I pick up on that is because I've realised that I do it for every song I ever introduce.
Can I? Yeah, I might just. I don't know. See.
Don't worry about it.
That would probably drive me insane. Okay, so then we'll have listened to this track. And then. So on to luxury item and weapon and bottomless drink. And that was Rachmaninoff. Dr. Smith, we're coming to the end of our podcast today, but I do have a few final questions to ask you.
Okay.
You're allowed one luxury item to bring into this apocalypse. What would that item be?
Well, bearing in mind we've got to keep it clean, I think that my luxury item, whilst dealing with the solitude of being in the middle of this zombie apocalypse, would probably be the ability to play Hearts on a computer. One of the things that sometimes when I'm on my own and not much to do is to switch the PC on and challenge myself to, I've been doing this for years, challenge myself to try and win a game of Hearts in four rounds by winning every single point in every single round. And if you don't do that, you start all over again. So you try to shoot the moon four times running, playing Hearts. So that would be my luxury. I know that doesn't sound like much of a luxury, but it would help to while away the hours.
You will also have one weapon of choice. What would you go for?
Right, well, I'm pretty handy with a hatchet. We have a wood burner at home, and one of my ways of relaxing on a Saturday is to go out and split logs. And so I think I would use that as my weapon if I'm going to be attacked by zombies. I can handle that reasonably well. I'm usually all fingers and thumbs, so giving me any other kind of anything with a sharp edge is usually a pretty dangerous thing to do. So let's make it that, a small wooden hatchet.
And after a day of brutally hatching innocent zombies, I'm going to do it. And after a day with your wood axe, you will after a long day with your wood axe, you will undoubtedly be tired and in need of a drink whilst listening to your tracks and reading your books. If you had one bottomless drink to bring with you, what would it be?
It would be a never-ending bottle of London Pride. That's my tipple of preference for two reasons. One is I like it, but also it's very odd. My wife always says when we go to London, it's the one place where I seem to be completely at home. My family came from London. I didn't grow up in London. I grew up in Bedford, as I think I mentioned earlier. But that's part of the kind of thing of who I am. London is kind of my hometown. And some of your listeners might know that it's also the name of a flower and a song written by Noel Coward during the Blitz about the flower, London Pride, and the indestructibility of London. And that seems to me to be a good reason to drink it, and it's a very fine pint of ale.
So with Hearts, a wood axe, and a bottomless supply of London Pride, would you be happy?
Well, that would do for starters.
Perfect. Dr. Smith, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. You have made my job extremely easy. We will be back next week with a new guest who is going to be recording tracks with us. We'll be back next week keeping tracks with a new guest. Find all our guests on our Twitter and social media accounts. Once again, Dr. Smith, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Finn.
I've been Finn, and this is Keeping Tracks on URN.
Well done.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, and it's a wrap.
And it's a wrap.